You're listening to the Elmira Radio Hour, a podcast that opens the door to culture and news you definitely missed this week. We're your hosts, Nina Bhattacharya
and Sheila Lal.
This week, we talk about Desi drinks, policy and process, feminist businesses, Sheila's chai game, and much, much more. You'll notice that this episode was recorded a couple weeks ago. Both Sheila and I have hashtag life stuff going on, so we apologize for the delay. We're also in the middle of working on a really cool episode with some friends in Detroit, and we can't wait to share that with you in a few weeks. Okay, let's get to it. ਪਿੱਛੇ ਪਿੱਛੇ ਆਉਂਦਾ ਮੇਰੀ ਚੱਲ ਵੇ ਨਾਈ ਚੀਰੇ ਵਾਲਿਆ ਵੇਖਦਾ ਈ ਵੇ ਮੇਰਾ ਲੌਂਗ ਵਾਚਾ ਪਿੱਛੇ ਪਿੱਛੇ ਆਉਂਦਾ ਮੇਰੀ ਚੱਲ ਵੇ ਨਾਈ ਪਿੱਛੇ ਪਿੱਛੇ ਆਉਂਦਾ ਮੇਰੀ ਚੱਲ ਵੇ ਨਾਈ ਚੀਰੇ ਵਾਲਿਆ ਵੇਖਦਾ ਈ ਵੇ ਮੇਰਾ ਲੌਂਗ ਵਾਚਾ 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 Fuck it. I don't got time for this. So, okay, that was recorded. I attempted to use a fancy mic. Failed. So I'm back to my iPhone headphones. And I'm definitely going to eat a sandwich as I talk to you.
That's fine. Yeah, I made rajma that didn't suck. And I made pulsambol and hoppers.
You're living the dream.
I am. It only took me like 4 years to get there, but I did it. That's what matters.
So, but hoppers though, like how do you make a hopper?
So I did like a pretty bastardized version of the batter. I didn't let it sit overnight. It's basically rice flour and coconut milk with some like activating agent. In this case, I used yeast. You can use beer in some recipes. And I happened to get a small pan from TJ Maxx that makes it, it's more of like an upbum as opposed to a hopper because it's not like bowl shaped, it's pan. So it's a little bit doughier, but you know what? I'm going to take it.
Hey, add everything else. Also like pulsambol, so good. So good. Also, you're going to have to add out these awesome chewing sounds. I apologize in advance.
Actually, no. We're grown women who have things to do.
I thought it'd be... Okay, that's going to be in there. So I thought it was... I thought it was going to be fun to, like, record me making the drink as I talk to you. Because Sheila had her shit together and made the Sheila sunrise slash sunset, depending on how you're feeling that day.
Exactly.
But
which is watermelon lime mint juice, one part rum or any clear liquor of your choice, and one part seltzer.
And it is delicious.
Quite tasty.
It was a classic invented in Sri Lanka, correct?
Exactly. Yes. It was called my coping mechanism. Fine. Are you making the filter coffee martini?
Yes, I'm making a filter coffee martini. Well, okay. I'm so cold coffee is like pretty desi, where you like shake it up with the ice. So I'm doing more like cold coffee. The benefit is that like after we do this episode, I have to like stay up all night and do work. So coffee.
That's perfect.
So the things I realize are that I don't have regular milk. I just have chocolate milk. I have devotion vodka. I don't know what this is. It says, if you're going to be bad, be good.
You look really unimpressed with their marketing.
It says, it's made from 100% unadulterated commitment, determination, and dedication. Devotion. It's what's inside that counts. Enjoy your devotion responsibly. It's made in Temperance, Michigan.
Nice. Solid. The vodka I have was made in Columbia. It was made like 5 blocks away from me.
Devotion vodka made in Temperance, Michigan.
Also,
for the record... Made, like, someone definitely left it at my house after, like, a birthday party or something.
Love it.
And I have Africafe from Tanzania.
Ooh.
So that's my instant coffee part, which I'm going to need a spoon to open the can. So just one second.
Yeah.
Okay, so speak to me. What was frustrating about the meeting you had today?
So I went to a healthcare town hall, mm-hmm. which was organized by actual organizers as opposed to institutions. And they invited everybody in the Boone County delegation.
Okay.
The Republican representatives were incredibly disrespectful and refused to show up because they thought that the crowds were too unruly and not a conducive place to talk about policy. They, quote, did not want to comment on the future of healthcare. Keep in mind it's legislative spring break and they're supposed to be talking to constituents.
Also, like, healthcare is a current policy issue.
Like, yeah. Also, like, healthcare isn't just, like, Medicaid expansion or the ACA or... what we have is like Senate Bill 28, which would convert how we get federal funding for Medicaid into a block grant, which is a horrible policy idea. It's like this, you can expand it to like the prescription drug monitoring program, which is a bipartisan issue. You can talk about newborn screening expansion, which like is an easy win in Missouri. Like healthcare has so many different facets and they're just quote unquote too afraid of talking to, okay, it's not really a quote, it's really how they feel. They're too afraid of constituents. And our senator didn't show up. So it was just two Democrats talking to a room full of leftists and like new activists, which is fine, but they also let people who are not elected officials talk when this mm-hmm. is a town hall for elected officials who don't have enough time in their schedule normally to come and speak to constituents. So why are you eating their time with like essentially like a circle jerk ideological speech? That was like the first reason I wanted to pull my hair out. The second thing was like nobody understands process. Like they keep saying that like Senate Bill 28 is still a possibility. Senate Bill 28, which is the Medicaid block grant, is dead. Like it was, they did like a 30-minute quote-unquote debate in the Senate. Nobody wants it. They laid it over. It's not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Like don't make it like, yes, you can call your senator, but we should really be talking about how to deal, like how to learn about budget, how to like be tuned into that, how to like push back against the horrific budget cuts that are coming down the pipeline, because we have currently a $200 million budget gap in this fiscal year and we're seeing a $500 million budget cut in the upcoming year. And like, why aren't we talking about tax policy and like tax cuts and like the weird special interest loopholes or like the 600 or 700 tax cuts or tax credits that are being offered that nobody seems to know about. Like they're not talking about like an interdisciplinary look at process, and nobody understands that like our people, like our elected representatives at the state level can't do anything about the ACA. Don't bring it up. Also, Medicaid expansion has been dead on arrival in Missouri for years, and especially this year. When the Senate pro tem doesn't want it and he like messed with how the Senate appropriations chair was going to be picked just to ensure we can't get it.
Well, just people know that. Like, I mean, part of it is there is a pretty, I'll say like at least getting the intricacies of what you just mentioned is important, but it's also it's a steep learning curve for a new activist. For sure. Okay. So like, So I think, so, like, the critique is super valid, and one, I agree completely, but I'm just like, man, that's for a new activist, I think they just need whoever, I guess it's more like the onus of whoever's organizing to ensure that the people that they are pulling together have a way to access information, right?
So this is actually my favorite part, is there's a big Facebook group, and, like, all of my friends who have been in this space for a while, and like I'm the newest one out of all these people, mm-hmm. we're in it too, and we offer these resources time and time again. We're mm-hmm. like, hey, like this is like, I'll put in like my Missouri legislature policy update. I'm like, subscribe to this if you want to know about bills that are like explained in a very colloquial way. Or here's a podcast that I do with these legislators that explain these topics in depth. Or here's like some other information. Or do you have questions about process? We're here to answer. And then nobody picks up on that. And it's not that they don't see it. It's not welcomed as a resource because we're seen as like part of the establishment. It's like process isn't going to go away. So I reached out to one of the bigger organizers and I was like, hey, like I was at this town hall and there seems to be a big disconnect and I'm more than happy to share what I know because I do this for a living. And she responded positively. So I'll hopefully be doing some workshops with activists to like explain how a bill becomes a law and how they can interject themselves in the process.
No, that sounds productive. Yeah. I mean, I will say like process is important, but it also sometimes it is okay when people don't pay attention to it. Not to the extent that you're mentioning, but I think part of like the broader like capital D democratic problem was was just so much about process and party line that anything that wasn't party line just didn't get captured. So
yeah, for sure.
So that mine is just a yes and no, and I like the workshops sound awesome. So it'd be good to hear how they actually go. Also, I'm gonna shake this for a second.
No, go do it.
Oh, this is such stress relief. Oh my god.
It's just like it's like I get at the federal level it can be difficult, but at the state level, like we're halfway through session, we keep losing. Like we get that, but also this session I think is an opportunity because the infrastructure is set up in a way that we're never gonna win to learn how to do this so we can be more effective for the special elections that we have coming up and then for next year. And I think that, I don't know, when people say out loud at town halls that policy makes their eyes glaze over, don't say that. Like, policy is where they beat us then. Because they're like, oh, I don't get how a bill is written. Ask somebody who does. Like, I think there's like this, in a smaller town, our egos, or a lot of people's egos are flaring up as opposed to wanting to work cooperatively to do better.
Yeah.
So, like, I know, like, my ego will flare up, but I don't let it get in the way. So I try to be, like, compromising, and I try to, like, be a resource and position myself where I'm not, like, over-explaining or being patronizing.
I can still
feel this way, but I'm trying to, like, mitigate that.
I think you're doing a great job of separating, like, personal irritation, which is reasonable to feel because, like, we're all humans experiencing burnout and a lot of stress and super long weeks, hence making Desi-inspired drinks and consuming them while recording late at night on, like, our headphones. And then you have the other side, which is, like, in order to make any change happen, we're going to have to be able to, like, compromise and make ourselves available and not let our egos get in the way. And, I mean, I think that's a good election lesson, which is Democrats, progressives, however you identify yourself, be more humble.
Yeah.
And if you're not humble and we all think we each know everything, then we're going to end up in the same position in 2 years during midterm elections.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So that's been like a really cool thing with this session is, again, like knowing we're going to lose, everyone's just taking the opportunity to like get to know each other a little bit better. And, like, I know, like, personally, I have stopped caring about the idea of, like, hierarchy or power access or political power.
Sometimes I just pause and think, like, state legislators are really random people. Yes. And then the other thing I just pause and, like, think about, too, is in college, I was super involved in college Dems and, like, leadership and stuff. And I knew the kind of, like, local party folk and legislative aides fairly well at that time. And I feel like the more people start getting involved in how like local politics work, they'll just realize it's all run by random people. I feel like when we read news articles and stuff, it's made out to be like this big, scary unit of a thing, which, right?
It can happen.
And also, I mean, this isn't to say that these random people don't make decisions that impact our lives in really important ways, right?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they're just like, they could be your neighbor. Like, I don't know. It's just like, sometimes I would just think, like, if you only knew the type of people who became legislative aides and, like, advisors and really random people. Okay, that was kind of incoherent, but
But that's the thing. Like, I think that we haven't demystified the idea of an elected official. If you read a bio or if you ask somebody who works with those elected officials about that person, you realize like a lot of them are not particularly interesting. No. But, like, they've led kind of, like, mundane lives.
Boring-ass lives.
Yeah. And it's, like, they just happened to do this because, at least in the case of Missouri, the Republican Party tapped them and was, like, you do this because you have the time to run. And we will fund you.
And also, like, all the people, the staffers that surround these folks, it's, like, college students, just out of college students, people who are learning from just kind of sort of, like, messing up and failing a lot. And, like, but no one sees that. I think that is the main thing about the West Wing. Not to down on the West Wing, but, like, it gives it the mystique that isn't real. Because, like, it's all random people.
It is. And, like, this is an interesting conversation about, like, where state legislatures are located. So a lot of them are located literally in the middle of nowhere. Like, Tallahassee, Florida is located in the most inconvenient spot in Florida. Jeff City is located in the middle of nowhere. So the people who are working there are people who are, like, invested in staying in state government because of, like, benefits later on, pension or, like, health insurance. So it's, like, older people. And it's, like, folks who are just working in the state.
Yep.
And it's not necessarily policy wonks or folks who, like, think more, like, conceptually. It's just, like, it's random folks doing this job. And that's great. Like, I think that, I mean, I'm
and also
all
that,
for
the, like, part-time equitable stuff, too.
Yeah. And, like, the part-time legislatures.
People don't know, like, yeah, a lot of people have, like, other jobs. If, especially if they're part-time legislators. So.
Yeah. Like, Florida has a three-month session, which is crazy to me. Like, how do you get anything done? Missouri has a five-month legislative session. They don't get anything done. So how does Florida get anything done?
They don't.
Yeah.
Obviously. Wait, I mean, they're talking about Florida. Like, what?
So I think that it's, like, I think you made a really valid point, though, that these are random people doing this work. No one's being really being groomed to understand policy.
No, I mean, like, no mystique. Take away the mystique from politics.
Yeah. And I think that, like, that's starting to happen with, like, the Save the ACA stuff, where it's, like, no, you work for me. You don't get to, like, go to DC and hide away. We want to talk to you. We want to talk to your representative who's going to vote on this. You don't
also, like, if your constituents are pissed off at you and you think they'll be unruly, maybe, like, you shouldn't be representing them. Like,
or maybe you shouldn't be doing things that piss them off.
I feel like public opinion should be a good barometer on that, but nope.
Idea of if you don't do stupid things, people won't be mad at you or there won't be repercussions is, like, kind of what I've been thinking about when it comes to, like, quote-unquote tort reform. The set of bills that change how people have access to the legal system, but in particular Missouri is just, like, we're doing the most this year. So Senate Bill 43 changes how somebody can sue based on discrimination. So keep in mind, currently in Missouri, there are no protections for sexual orientation or gender identity. So you can be fired for being gay still in the state.
Same in Michigan.
You can be denied housing.
Yeah, I don't think we have an ENDA in Michigan. I would have to double check, but I'm pretty sure it didn't pass.
Awesome. Good job.
Lots of work to be done when you go to school in Michigan, Shields. Lots of work to be done. You'll be just as angry.
Looking forward to it.
You'll just be so angry and even more overworked because you'll be in grad school.
So on top of that, they have Senate Bill 43, which currently in the state of Missouri, if you want to sue based on discrimination or, like, if you're being discriminated on a protected class, because it's a really onerous process, but you just have to show that your identity, like, part of your identity was a contributing factor. Which should, like, you can say, oh, this happened, like, five or six times to me, but never happened. Like, if I was reprimanded five or six times as a brown woman, but, like, my white male counterpart who did the exact same thing was never reprimanded, and then I was fired. Mm-hmm. Like, I can show that it was a contributing factor. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so now they're changing it to being a motivating factor, which essentially says you, or what it means is, I would have to get an email explicitly stating that I was fired for being brown or for being a woman.
Which, hint, doesn't really happen because racists have brains.
Yeah. And so the whole, like, the logic on the right for this type of legislation is, oh, it'll discourage, or it'll stop frivolous lawsuits. Hi, maybe if people don't discriminate, there won't be a lawsuit. Maybe if they just did the right thing.
Also, lawsuits aren't frivolous. Like, right? do they not get, like, how much they cost?
So, like, the underlying reason for these sets of bills is to take away money from trial attorneys who historically fund Democrats.
Oh, there we go. That makes sense.
Yeah.
There had to be something more. Speaking of protection of sexual and gender minorities, I have been thinking a lot about thanks lately.
Me too.
I've been thinking about thanks. So thanks is that period underwear that keep popping up in your sponsored ads on Facebook, or at least mine.
If you're a woman, I've asked men about this and it doesn't appear on their Facebook.
I wonder if it appears on people whose, like, gender pronoun on Facebook is, like, whatever. Mm-hmm. Because, actually, the reason I'm bringing this up is that it's a company that on the front has developed a reputation as a feminist business, mm-hmm. Like accepting of like destigmatizing menstruation, innovating in a space that doesn't get innovated very often. If you think about mm-hmm. it, like, pads all look the same, tampons yeah. pretty much all look the same, right? So everyone was really cool, you know, excited and cool about it. They had some, like, really buzzy ad campaigns and like fruits and vaginas and like millennial pink advertising, which, you know, I love a good millennial pink. So it was supposed to, you know, these period panties, amazing, great, South Asian CEO. And so, like, I mean, Things also was known for, like, these really insane, like, PR pitches. Mm-hmm. There have been articles where journalists have been like, hey, I got, like, did you get this email from their PR person? It sounds, like, really bonkers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, like, all of this extra, like, super enthusiastic, like, slang that hasn't been invented, no one knows and understands. Okay. So now there's been, in the past few weeks, coming out a sexual assault allegations about the CEO, Mickey Agarwal, among other labor issues as well, mm-hmm. like abusive language, etc., that have caused multiple people to leave and a lot of defensive reactions from the company. The thing that has made me the most disgusted about the situation mm-hmm. is that one of their seminal ad campaigns was with an a gender model named Tyler Ford. And this was amazing because it just was acknowledging that people have periods, not just people who identify as women. Mm-hmm. And that there's still, like, needs to be products that acknowledge and account for people's, like, biological processes, regardless yeah. of their gender identity. So having someone super visible being in this ad campaign was just, like, really powerful. And I don't know, I was just really excited and happy. And it was something I was attuned to because, like, my thesis work has been on trans and non-binary youth. But then in, like, the recent reports, which have been the kind of, like, exclusives, the reporting has been done by RACT. Mm-hmm. Which has, like, really, amongst all kind of, like, the fashion and shopping articles, does some really cool fashion reporting. They published that Tyler Ford had been tokenized mm-hmm. In the recruiting process and also in, like, the campaign process, and that they experienced a lot of discomfort that they hadn't been able to voice until now, which just makes me so sad to hear that someone was reduced to like simply one aspect of their identity in order for like financial gain for a company. Like, there's a nice way to do it, and that wasn't a nice way. Anyway, so I feel angry, a lot of angry feels about that.
So my like two reactions to the pieces that have come out, like the New York Magazine piece that came out, and then there was another piece talking about like how she cultivated a work environment.
Mm. Yeah, that's from Racked. Misogyny.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And my reactions were like inherently a company that purports to be feminist and like pushes that as its main messaging, I think is overcompensating. Mm-hmm. And I think that consumers are savvy enough to know if a company actually embodies that ideology, and you can see it in how the business model is structured, how like HR, which Thinx doesn't have an HR department, but like you can tell if like labor is done in a feminist or intersectional way. And
you really think
the
product, that
like the outcome is,
and just to pause you for a second, you really think that the average person can, who like isn't us talking right now, can identify whether the, or like the company's being run in a feminist way? Like, I feel like since post-election, around the election, there's just been such an influx of people with capitalist mindsets being opportunists and like taking advantage,
that's really fair.
Advantage of like the buzziness of feminism at this juncture to sell products.
That's really fair. I think about it so much.
Okay.
That's very fair. I shouldn't project onto other people. Like when I look at businesses like Thinx or like honestly some like quote unquote feminist musicians, like to me, like having to label that is very, like you are overcompensating for something. And if you view the world intersectionally, like it should be in all of these different facets.
Mm-hmm.
And in your outcome is going to be stronger. And consumers, like there's conscientious consumerism. And that's why these companies have started to succeed, is because a younger generation is like, yes, I will spend a little bit more money to support an organization or company that says it, or like that has this product that seems to be fulfilling different needs. So for instance, like Thinx being gender nonconforming, where it is for process, not for identity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just like, whenever it just like is a red flag for me when I see like, this is a feminist thing. I'm like, I don't know. Like, I would like to like understand a little bit more. And like, it's for me, it's like akin in a very like separated way to like a white person being, I'm not racist, I have a black friend.
Mm.
Like, I'm a feminist because I'm saying so, but like not showing it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also I like your point about, which is something I hadn't thought about, which is like, if there's a company I'm curious about to see if they have an HR department, like regardless, like variable efficacy and effectiveness of HR departments, but like the fact that Thinx didn't even have one in existence is kind of telling to me. So that means all the decision-making power is resting within one person.
The CEO. Yeah. And then on top of that, like, I don't know why folks seem so surprised that a brown woman could be a proponent and complicit in patriarchal and misogynistic behavior.
No, like, that does not surprise me at all.
No. Like, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine about how, like, brown women, especially, like, Hindu brown women, have an expansive amount of privilege. And, like, feel like they benefit – for a lot of them – sorry, I should be, like, clarifying that. There is a lot of, like, caste-based migration that doesn't go – that does not go checked or goes unchecked. Mm-hmm. There we go. And I can, like, go into a lot of, like, my ideas on how, like, anti-Dalit sentiment, like, anti-blackness are tied together, like, model minority myths mean in terms of how we process, like, our experience with whiteness. Mm-hmm. And – why we think that we are like going to be saved. And like in the post 9/11 world, you see that a lot of like generally Hindu Americans like don't speak up. We're not like allying ourselves with our Muslim communities or black communities. And that is playing out in this situation where this brown Hindu, or Sikh, she's Sikh. she's like perpetuating white supremacy in a way, like she sees that it benefits her, maybe not like explicitly or conscientiously, but like perpetuates it because she doesn't see it as a problem.
Yeah.
You know, like I was just thinking about that, and like, I'm not ever surprised by like brown women being shitty.
No, I'm not there. I mean, like, I know you put in a lot of caveats and stuff, which are like helpful in understanding that brown, like South Asian Hindu women aren't a single thing. But there is like a large chunk who have,
yeah,
upper middle class, occupying college campus spaces, like reinforcing certain beauty stereotypes and norms and homophobic behavior, anti-black behavior, like, oh, like I could date this guy, but like, yeah, if he's black, I can't like bring him home, you know, like that kind of mentality, or God forbid a Muslim, haha, like that, they're those people do exist, and it's just, it is really annoying to see, like,
yeah,
it's hard to tell. I mean, this is, I think it's hard because sometimes I'm like, is Nina, is this just your ego getting in the way, like, of like your ego of like who is a feminist and who isn't a feminist? But sometimes I'm like, do they really actually get what is at stake? They're identifying themselves as feminists. Like, are they posting that like inspirational image on Instagram or something in solidarity for International Women's Day because they actually get what's at stake? Or are they doing it because it's another trend?
And so this was something I brought up with a friend of mine, and her question right back was, what does Hindu social justice look like? And I'm not the person to answer that, but I was like, hey, I know somebody who is. So I'm curious, like, what does social justice rooted in Hindu texts, and that's a very broad question, look like to you?
Right. So just first disclaimer is, like, everyone can – Hindu texts can mean different things to different people, and people – some people have, like, very painful relationships with how those texts have been used to oppress their families and their communities over generations. So that's acknowledging anti-Dalit sentiment that is incredibly pervasive in India and recreated in the United States. So that disclaimer aside, I do think it is possible to have a social justice that is rooted in Hinduism, because I believe in the interpretation that whatever higher energy, happiness, power, God, whatever you want to call it, you, me, you know, like namaste and yoga class, that's saying like the God in you is the same as God in me. I believe there is a oneness. Everything is the same. And that if you believe everything is the same, or like we are all one, and we're seeing that in the world that we're living in that is not operationalized, then we should be doing everything in our power to rectify it, to so that it reflects the higher vision in our texts. So just to say it in like plainer English, I guess, if I am seeing that we're discriminating against women in our healthcare policies, or we're preventing like housing services for sexual and gender minority youth, I would do everything in my, like, it's on me to rectify that inequality. Like, if I see injustice, I should at least feel motivated to learn more about it, or take action on something that I can. I think that's what keeps me going. So that's like the basic way I think about how Hinduism is reflected or can inform social justice work. I also think that there's a lot of like powerful like feminine energy type stuff. Like,
first of all, it's very Bengali of you. Second, continue.
You know, Yes. I was going, you know, the next word out of my mouth is going to be Ma Durga. Like, Durga Ma, Kali Ma, like, these are all, like, really badass, wonderful, like, powerful manifestations mm-hmm. of feminine energy, like, correcting wrong in the world, essentially. That's how I think of it. Whether that's right or quote-unquote right, quote-unquote wrong, I don't really know, but I've been trying to learn a lot more in this past year, yeah. and I'm like, you know, I'm in that weekly Gita class, so that's been a really cool opportunity to actually go systematically yeah. go through that text, which I haven't really had the opportunity to do that, because mm-hmm. it's so, like, dense and intimidating. It's really helpful to have, like, mm-hmm. another person guide you through it and then reflect on it, so that has been really useful.
Yeah, I really... Okay, so, like, kind of piggybacking off of that, so, like, my grandmother died 2 weeks ago, and she was the only religious one in the family, and so we arranged a Hindu ceremony, our Hindu funeral for her, and something I thought was, I think, one of the most, like, stark realizations out of the entire process was how little, like, contemporary information there is for Hindu funerals in the U.S., but, like, take into account that you're not living in an Indian community or a Hindu community per se. And so we found, like, a lot of contradicting information. We found a lot of stuff that wasn't, like, practical. And I think that, like, you're talking about your Gita class, and I'm thinking I would really love for there to be, like, more publication on contemporary Hindu thought and contemporary Hindu modeling and practices for, like, even for somebody like me who is not religious, but am just, like, have a passing curiosity, or, like, if a loved one is going through something, being able to understand that a little bit better to do my best to support them.
I think that what you're mentioning makes me think of a question someone posed in one of the Facebook groups we're a part of, who's actually, like, an old classmate of mine, asking, like, what is mental health? What does Hinduism say about mental health issues? So I agree. There needs to be more widely published information about it. I think what is widely published for, like, in outlets for of our generation is talking about, like colorism and Hindu practice. I will say there is a lot of publication about caste. Dalit activists have been super on the front lines of making their voices heard, which is really important.
Right, and I've seen a lot of really cool stuff. When holidays come around, a lot of really cool articles that kind of show a subaltern, in quote-unquote, voice within Hinduism.
But there is, to your point, not a lot out there for people who are curious. Like, I want to sort of incorporate something into my life, or at least know about it. Like, what are ways I can use this as a lens to think about things I'm going through right now? Ideas for after I graduate.
So, like, just, like, you're talking about your Gita class, and I know, like, reflections are personal, but I would love to see, like, kind of like a dissemination of what that chapter of the Gita is, and, like, ways to apply it. Like, so it's not emotionally tied to you, but it's accessible to other people. And I'm not saying you have to do it, but just that's what sparked my brain.
Oh, I want to talk to you about something. I could be gently reduced to, like, problematic faves. But, okay, so I've been a couple different things. Like, I've been reading a ton about the colonial history behind public health and global health, and it's, like, fucked up. Which, I mean, I knew it was fucked up, but, you know, the ways public health, global health, demography, so how populations grow and change are, like, vastly informed by, like, colonial fears about a surplus of brown and black bodies. That's in scare quotes, guys, just for the record. Health was a way to ensure, like, productivity of the colonies, and also to ensure that, like, white colonists survived, because otherwise they were just straight up dying. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to it of, like, how all of this was, health was conceptualized with geography and race and colonialism. But So one kind of like panic moment I had was like, how do I continue working in a space that has this kind of history? And that's, you know, still informs in some ways, mm-hmm. whether we actively think about it or not, the work that we do today that we think is, that mm-hmm. is good.
Yeah.
So grappling with that, because all fields are like yeah. that, you know, so it's not just a public health, global health thing. I'm just citing it because like that's the thing I'm most familiar with. You know, another example is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, which is, I don't want to cry, but like, that just makes me bummed. But, you know, acknowledging she has put out a lot of really excellent work into the world, and she is shaped by a context and a history herself, mm-hmm. But has said mm-hmm. something that is really hurtful to a large group of people. Mm-hmm. You do see that tension? These are just like two examples of like, there is this history, good or bad, and like this thing, and like, how do you just compartmentalize? Like, is it a matter of just acknowledging that these exist and like, it's better to operate in the world with knowledge rather than ignorance, rather than just not knowing about it at all, or not knowing that colonial history?
That's how I operate. That's how I choose to like positively exist in this world, is just embody the knowledge and understand that it's there. Like, I can't go back in time and like ensure that white colonial settlers don't enter the subcontinent or don't like go to the Berlin Conference of 1865 and divvy up the entire African continent. Like, understanding that there are ramifications, I think, has been really helpful. And the Chimamanda situation, where she talks about the idea of male privilege and trans bodies, I chose not to read any of the think pieces. Like, I saw it blow up on Twitter and I was like, I will delve into this later. I'll like start paying attention once like the initial like outrage happens, and then I'll let it, like, I want it to settle down, because I like to take that time to reflect.
Yeah, I think the general approach that you alluded to in the beginning, which is also letting things settle down before engaging with it, because in the flurry of think pieces that happened, and like, I find that if I read every single one, which sometimes that ends up happening depending on the topic and how I'm feeling, like, I feel very, like, even more indignant or agitated about the issue at hand in a way that I might not have if I, like, stopped and reflected for a while or just revisited it on a different day.
Yeah. And I think it's also how I've trained myself to absorb, like, bigger ideas, mm-hmm. is, like, I want to, there's only so much my brain can handle at one time. So, like, mm-hmm. I focus on work, and then things that are important to me, like conversations mm-hmm. around social political work or like art or mm-hmm. global politics, I wait until backlash subsides so I can get a more in-depth idea of what's happening and what the impact actually is or context actually looks like.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
But like in the complete inverse of that, I saw Get Out 2 weekends ago, and like immediately started reading more of the think pieces. Like, I'd read some of them, but tried to find more like analytical think pieces, mm-hmm. which I found to be surprisingly difficult. Like, there were good think pieces, but I wanted something that delved more into like how the film was constructed as opposed to like the messaging.
This is speaking as someone who's read the think pieces without having watched the movie yet, which is like, Jordan Peele was on Another Round.
Yep. Yeah.
But he was also on Still Processing. And I'd actually tune into his conversation on Still Processing.
Okay.
Because it is oriented as more of like a film and entertainment podcast. They talk more about like horror and this idea of like a social thriller. There's like a very specific kind of terminology that he uses to talk about it.
That's really helpful. I also listened to the episode of In the Thick, where they had the Andre character and then another filmmaker talk about the movie. Mm-hmm. And that was nice. That was like useful in understanding their lived experiences. And then For Colored Nerds also did a good breakdown of Get Out in Black film context. Like, this is the first time, this year has been the first time in 2 years that I've had downtime, because I don't have a second job and I'm not canvassing. And so that being said, like, I have time to, like, get back to things I have loved before. And part of that is film analysis.
Which is good. That's, like, what you adore a lot. And I think is a good coping mechanism for you in particular. Good. Prioritize yourself as much as possible before you start school again.
Yes. That's what I'm trying to do. And, like,
to be fair, you are going to business school. So there is an emphasis on, like, having a social life.
Yes. Like, yes. I actually just got an email from the Asian American Club at Michigan. And they're like, we'll have a social before admit weekend actually starts. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, first of all, I don't have the liver for business school. Like, before even the financial stuff,
You will have one.
No, I don't have the liver, nor do I have the bank account for the social life at business school. And also, like, I really want to learn. Like, I took a 5-year gap because I really wanted to make sure that this is what I wanted. And I really want to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, you're so cute.
I've developed into...
We're like the same age, but you're so cute.
I've developed into the nerd I knew I could always be.
Yo, it's a good place to be.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm really excited to, like, learn things.
I'm so happy. Ann Arbor is totally my favorite place. Guys, like, if Sheila's going to be in Ann Arbor and I went to school in Ann Arbor and my family's in Michigan, it means that I can actually see her more than, like, once or twice a year.
Yo, my mom saw that your parents wanted to pseudo-adopt me, and her reaction was, oh, thank God. Like, you're right, Mom. I actually can't take care of myself. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, like, my dad works in Ann Arbor. Like, you got a home food hookup, is all I'm saying.
I'm so excited. like, yeah, I'm pretty stoked about that.
Oh, it'll be so good. You know, on Twitter, one of my friends had mentioned Elmira Radio because her friends were thinking of starting a podcast, but, like, one of them was moving far away, and I was like, you know, like, a lot of podcasts are like friendship LDRs. Yeah. Like, but it would be nice if this wasn't as long of a long distance relationship. That's all. Which it won't be. So, like, I mean, like, we don't have to make sad faces, because that's going to change in, like, 6 months.
No, I'm just thinking about how I live in the middle of nowhere and how it makes it really difficult for me to have friends outside of Missouri. Like, I can have them virtually, but to see people is like $400 or $500. And it's a, like, 6-hour trip to even get there. And it's tiring. And I wish that wasn't the case.
Yeah. And also, to be fair, it's, and I'm acknowledging this too, it's like, when people are on the coasts in particular, it's really hard to get people to go anywhere else that isn't on the coast. Unless, yeah, like, they're from there. Which is actually kind of sad, because I think people would really benefit from going to places that aren't the coast. But
I mean, that's actually one of the big reasons that Michigan appealed to me as a school. It's like, oh, all this talent is forced to come to the Midwest.
No, it's good.
You are forced to understand, or, like, at least be exposed to what this part of the region, like, experiences on a day-to-day basis.
Yep.
And you can't, like, and I love big cities. I absolutely love them. I think that they're, like, liberal. Like, they're liberal because you're forced to interact with so many different types of people, and you want what's best for those people. But that being said, like, experiencing homogeneity, I think, is equally as valuable.
Totally. For, like, people who've never had the experience of not growing up around people who look like you, to have, like, a smidge of that experience is, it, like, helps you understand how people became who they are. Like, it helps people understand, like, how we can have Midwestern accents but still have certain cultural things that we hold super close to us, whether it's film or whether it's dance.
I don't know. It always boggles my mind when I meet people who are from the coast or like from a big city who seem really shocked that I can be a multifaceted human. And I'm like, you are too. So I don't know. My geographic region really determined, like,
or like, that. You are not, so. And then sip your chai.
Unrelated, I have upped my chai game, so I'm pretty excited about that.
So both Sheila and I hosted our friends, Usaid and Cassie, wonderful co-directors and filmmakers of this documentary called Generation Revolution, which talks about the new generation of Black and Brown activists in London, and it was fabulous. And so they came here to Boston, and then they were in Columbia, right?
Yeah. They like stopped, like they got paid by the journalism school to show their film. And it was right after True False, which had a lot of films about like anti-Blackness, racism, police brutality, but also Black power and activism. Mm-hmm. And so it was really interesting for Generation Revolution to screen like 2 days after True False was done.
So cool. And we both moderated our respective panels for them.
We did.
Which is extra lovely.
Yes. Like, I got an email from one of my good friends who's a programmer for the independent movie theater. He's like, hey, do you mind doing the Q&A? And I was like, first of all, I would do anything for you, Chris. Second, obviously.
And three, like they're right at my place.
Well, yeah, they actually just came over. They had a hotel room. They got set up.
Nice. Good.
Yeah, so like during True False, they screened Who's Streets, which was about Ferguson activism and protests. And then we saw The Force, which was about the Oakland Police Department and kind of at the...
Oh, like, boy.
It starts where Who's Street leaves mm-hmm. off. So it's like when Oakland starts to get involved with police, like protesting police brutality. I mean, with regards to Ferguson, and obviously Oakland has been very mm-hmm. political for a long time. And then like I ended my True False weekend with I Am Not Your Negro, the James Baldwin movie. And so we have all these ideas floating around and like new thought and ideas of how to operate within and then push back against white supremacy in like a political sphere. And then Generation Revolution, in my opinion, was an extension and even more pushback because it's like, hey, anti-Blackness and racism is not just an American problem. It's everywhere, but also, I don't know, I really appreciated like this idea that like brown and Black allyship is very visible. And like it's something that I think our communities need to aspire to.
It's the same, same, but different.
Exactly. Wow. Hey, Indonesia. and like moderating that Q&A was really great. And they were talking about chai for some reason at dinner. And I was like, hey, you guys should come over. And they watched the film that I made during my Fulbright. Mm-hmm. And I made them chai.
Oh, yeah. So that was the beginning part of our conversation, which was Sheila's upped her chai game. Usaid and Cassie like drink a ton of chai. So
yeah. So I felt good that they did not hate my chai.
I think we made it. We made it through another episode, which is great.
You can always find us on the internet at Queen of Blah, at Only Nina, at Almira Radio, on Facebook, where we share a lot of links, and on the Tumblr and on Gmail. If you really wanted to reach us, if those other ways weren't good enough. And of course, we're going to be on Stitcher, SoundCloud, and iTunes.
If you love us, leave us a review. Okay, bye.
Bye.